accession number 23228 Real 1.
Professor Hugh de Wardener, Real One. So if I could ask you, first of all, to tell me something about your family background, whereabouts you were born and raised.
It's terribly complicated. I was born in Paris, of American parents. And my mother had come to Paris to learn to sing. And my father... That's a complicated part too, because he was born in America, being American. But he was born of a Belgian mother who had an English grandmother, grandmother. So when my grandfather died, the three children, three brothers, born in Brooklyn, came to Paris to live. And having been sort of inculcated by a grandmother, the best education was in England. My father was therefore sent with his two brothers to Bedford Grammar School. We're talking about the 1910s now. So there was my father, who was an American and lived in America until presumably he was about adolescent, and then went to public school, lived in Paris, and met my mother, who was just in transit with her mother to learn to sing. And these two Americans met and married. And they married, I think, 1914, and I was born in 1915 in Paris. And I lived in Paris and France for a long time. My father left us very early on, and I never really saw him again. So I was brought up by my mother and mainly by my nanny. We had a French nanny. And so I spoke only French till I was about 8. And my mother wandered about Europe as far as I can say. It's amazing how, as a child, you never ask questions, do you? Or even later on. I mean, I would love to ask all sorts of questions now. What on earth were we doing all over Europe? But she wandered and swanned about. And it was great fun. My nanny was with me. And I first went to school in Lausanne, and then in Florence. Couldn't speak a word of Italian, and then in Rome. And then we went to America for a year, and that's where I learned to speak rather Texan-American in New Mexico, because the maid was Texan. And I said, "Watter," to my mother's horror. And then I was sent back. I think my grandfather, my mother's father, was a bit fed up with all this. And he said, "I think you better get a job." I don't know, I'm extrapolating, but I think he... So she learned how to type and take shorthand. And eventually she went to Bloomingdale's and worked there, and then she had the bright idea of telling Bloomingdale that they ought to have an office in Paris, which they bought. So she moved to Paris, where she ran this office for the customers of Bloomingdale's. And I, in the meanwhile, had been sent back from America by myself across the Atlantic, I remember, which was great fun.
How old would you have been then when you were sent back?
About 8 or 9, by myself, but in charge of the purser, in the purser's, you know. And I was met by my nanny, and I was sent to a French school, a peculiar French school. It was for refugees, as far as I could see. I think it had been built up by the Americans. I'm not certain. I never really did know. Called Chavagnac, in the that bit of the mountainous part of France, to the, as you look at the map, to the left of the Rhone, you know, the Rhone on one side and the Cantal and the Dordogne on the other side, near the Mont d'Or and that sort of thing. And it had people from about 10, 8, 9, 10. Up to 18, a lot of Russians, a lot of white Russians. And I learned to swim there because they had a big outdoor pool. To say it was a pool, it was a natural thing, but a bit square. It must have been made by man, but it was covered with grass on the sides and trees. But one had to swim very quickly because because the big boys were inclined to push the little boys underneath. And this taught me to swim so quickly that when I went to school in England, I was the chief, the best swimmer. And from there, I was sent to school in England, prep school in Eastbourne, called Aldrow. And looking back on it, it's fascinating how a child just takes to anything, like duck to water. Okay, there I was. I spoke English with a strong French accent. And we were told what to buy, I remember, in the way of suits. And my dear mother bought me a suit, but she bought me a double-breasted suit. Well, you can imagine it, in an English prep school, a double-breasted suit didn't go down at all. But how was she to know? But I was extremely lucky in my youth. I've always been lucky throughout my life. Everything I've done has always been lucky. Always. In fact, I've begun to think that a sort of aphorism that if you don't put your trust in God, he'll look after you. Don't count on him, but he'll look after you. And I was very big as a boy, very big. I think I was about 5'10" when I was 12, something like that, or 13. So I was never bullied. Which, looking back, was a wonderful thing. I was totally always free from bullying. In fact, when I went to my next school, which was Malvern College, my best friend was a small boy, and he had a congenital nystagmus. This is a thing when you look to the side, or even when you look straight, your eyes keep twitching all the time. Well, you can imagine how little boys would latch on to that. And I found myself sort of protecting him, you know. And any time any big boy started bullying, I always dealt with them. And that was, looking back, that was a wonderful luck to have been free from all bullying or any problems like that, which always gave me a sort of laid-back atmosphere. Always. Because I never had anything to fear. Always everything was easy.
It's very interesting that, you know, with your travels, and particularly on the continent after World War One, did you get any sort of impressions of that war? Did it impinge in any way on your life? You were born in 1915, so you were very young, of course, during the war.
Yes,
are there any memories at all that you have?
One's memories are memories of memories, aren't they? You don't really experience, when you bring them back, what it was like at the time. You remember what you when you last remembered it. So that, it's difficult to distinguish what was told to me and what I picked up. They're not much to do with the war, I must admit. I remember we lived in a little street called the Rue Goethe, which is near the Pont de l'Allemagne in Paris. And there's a big street, I'm not quite certain, which goes from the Étoile down to the Pont de l'Allemagne. And there used to be parades occasionally. And I remember that very French band, which consists of horns and trumpets, and going down the street. And also I remember very well the horses' hooves outside the house, because the road, it was a little street which was quite deserted. So when a horse went down it reverberated. I remember that. I remember being circumcised. It had nothing to do with the war, but they circumcised me late. I think I must have been about a year old, and I remember every detail of it. It was terrible, absolutely awful. They did dry dressings once a day. Every day, dry dressings. And they dressed it with our iodoform, and I'll come back to our iodoform when we get to Thailand later. I remember that. Oh, what else do I remember? Not much. I lived with my uncle for a week or two, much later on, and he had a maid called Louise who had a husband called Jean, and Jean had been in the war, and I remember trying to extract from Jean what it was like. That's as near as I ever got to the First World War, and I remember him not saying much about it and being very, very reticent and not wanting to talk. But I do remember his being reticent and not wanting to talk about it. Otherwise, what does one remember about the war? The mutilés de guerre. There were signs of mutilés de guerre in the undergrounds and so on. I think that's about all, really. My father, I think, was joined in the American army, but had a rather undistinguished career doing something about harbours and ports and ships coming in and so on. I think that's all. He was not involved directly in the fighting.
When did you decide that you wanted to be a doctor? Was this during your school days? That's
my grandfather, my mother's side, was a doctor. Though I don't think I was really aware of that for a very long time. When we went to America, we stayed with them in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where my mother came from. And he was a general practitioner, Dr. Pierce. And I can't remember if this had much effect on me. I didn't like him much. I think I was pretty neutral about him until he put castor oil in some orange juice that he gave me because I had measles. And I never forgave him for that. Never, never, never forgave him. Poor fellow. And I think he probably did more for my welfare and supporting my mother and putting me through school and one thing and another. And yet this one incident damned him forever, you see. But there it was. My grandfather was a doctor. He trained at Johns Hopkins. And when I was at Malvern, I started to want to be a doctor. And I can't remember when it happened. I think it was so natural that it always did seem to me, as the obvious thing to do. I didn't want to do good. It had nothing to do with that. It's just that I liked the idea of doing medicine. But my mother was working in Paris, and she told me that we didn't have enough money to send me to medical school. So I decided that I would then make aeroplane engines instead. And we had in our school a fellow called Nixon. I think I discovered this after I decided to make aeroplane engines, perhaps not. And he became a Balliol scholar in mathematics, I remember. Scruffy Nixon, a little boy, scruffy hair. And I went into the maths fifth. I was not comfortable in maths, but I struggled on. And one day we had a formula, which was very long on each side of an equal sign in the middle, and it had to be solved. I could do nothing with this. So I went along the passage to Scruffy Nixon. I said, Scruffy, what do we do about this? He looked at it quite a long time, at least a minute or so. And then he put 2x on each side and it came right out. And I said, Scruffy, how did you know that? And he couldn't explain it. He didn't know. And it was probably one of the most important moments of my life. I suddenly realized mathematics is intuitive. I thought that I'd be able to learn it. Oh, no. Oh, no, all right, you learnt it. But the real mathematicians, as they learnt it, they intuitively felt comfortable with it. And I had none of this feeling. And I decided, I can't go and make aeroplane engines. I'll be against people who are intuitive, mathematically. So I wrote to my mother, because the decision about that had been taken some time before, and I said, is any possibility of doing medicine? Well, things obviously changed. She said, yes, that's all right. Yes. So I switched and did medicine, and I went into the science fifth, and then I went to Thomas's. And in those days, you could do your first MB. If you did high school cert and got a high enough certificates, you could avoid doing first MB. But I don't know. I went to the Thomas's and I did my first MB there. And I spent the usual 5 years doing medicine at St. Thomas's, which I greatly enjoyed.
Was it a good training? The 5-year training?
Yes. It certainly taught you things which you're not taught now. Diagnosis. Diagnosis was the important thing. And for diagnosis, you needed a history. And you had to get to know the patient. You had to examine the patient. All that was sort of de rigueur. I mean, this was obvious. Now it ain't, you see. You now that there are all sorts of formulae and ways of behaving and... it's quite different. Diagnosis is right down the list. Very sad. It'll come back. I'm sure one day some bright person will say, look, I think it's about time we focus on diagnosis. Anyhow, it was a good training. It was typical old-fashioned English, the way it used to be in universities too. For instance, university, if you went as a fellow, I know in some physiology departments, if you'd been picked to be as a fellow, they would say, well, now go off for 3 months and come back and tell us what you'd like to do. Now, that would never happen now. The idea that somebody should think for themselves, you know. No, and of course, the old-fashioned way of never organizing anything properly. I remember when we first switched from pre-medical to clinical, and it was a very important part in one's training, you finally got hold of the patients. You see, you're going to be allowed to be near them. Well, you wanted to know where you're supposed to be and who you're going to be with and when and so on. It was extremely difficult to find out. I mean, we all picked it up somehow or other. It was somewhere. But, and at that time, I didn't think that was very efficient. But when I see things now, I think it's far, far too dragooned. Everything is done like a factory now. This is one of the troubles. The Conservative government ruined the health scheme. The Labour have ruined medicine. Quite different. Labour tried to support the health scheme, but they ruined the doctors. The Conservatives, on the whole, ruined the health scheme, don't mind about the doctors. And, for instance, the Labour Party were the first people to put in overtime for doctors. Hey, come on, overtime. Totally foreign to the idea of doctoring. But they saw it as a shop floor. And now this time they've come in and they're doing it. They've put regulation after regulation after regulation. And it's like a factory. And I think, thank God I'm not doing medicine now. Oh, I wouldn't do it. I'd join the Médecins Sans Frontières, something like that. But I wouldn't do medicine. No. There's a regulation about everything. Everything has to be done by the book and so on. Yes, sorry, how did we get onto that?
So, well, you know, this is a very interesting comparison, isn't it?
Mm.
As you were saying, this old-fashioned way, which had so much to offer, really,
yeah,
in the way of training the whole person.
Of course, you see, we didn't know much medicine. I mean, we knew what there was. But
when I think of what we looked after in those days, it was rheumatic fever, tuberculosis, gastric ulcers. You never see rheumatic fever now. Gastric ulcers have disappeared. What else did I say? Rheumatic fever. Tuberculosis has disappeared. So the three main things medically. God, I remember you used to be able to go to the theatre. Theatres had balconies which you could go and sit and look at an operation. And what was going on in the theatres was posted downstairs. So if you wanted to see a particular operation, go. Half the lists were abdominal operations. Half of them. Incredible. All sorts of manoeuvres on the stomach to deal with peptic and duodenal ulcers. The wards were filled with TB. It was known to be due to a bug, but nobody thought of isolating. So that tuberculosis amongst the nurses and the students was enormous. At least, I should think 10-15% at least of your... Many group got TB on their way through the hospital. Yeah. This is long before BCG. My greatest friend, Alec Bone. Do you mind us just checking window? Alec Bone, who was he was a marvelous fellow, part of our year. And he had been at Westminster School. He had TB in his back before he came to school, which had delayed him a bit. And when he had a rather stiff back, he was easily the brightest, full of fun, and always dressed impeccably. It was so. I mean, now of course everybody tries to dress it like a ragamuffin. Never in those days we didn't dress particularly smartly, but Alec had a hard collar on, tweed coat and, you know, extremely well. But the greatest fun, marvellous brain. He was the sort of person at the end of took a 3-hour exam in an hour and a half and walked out and got top marks. Just 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, A, B, C, boom, 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 boom. And his story was that he, when the war started, he joined the Navy. And I remember writing to him or talking to him, I said, how on earth did they let you in? They didn't ask me to bend down. And Alec joined the Navy, and he was on the one of the cruisers, I think, or a destroyer, I can't remember, which sank the Bismarck. They sent the torpedoes, which actually did the final bit of sinking it. And he was then put on HMS Jolly in the Adriatic. It was sunk in the Adriatic. It was last seen going around cheering everybody up. Typical Alec.
What, how do you spell his surname?
Born. Bone, B-O-N-E.
B-O-N-E.
Yes, he got a DSC for that. I think he got a DSC before he went down.
It's interesting you talking about the diseases you, you know, were trained on. You were obviously seeing the results of the social conditions of the time.
Yes.
You know, were people living in appalling conditions? You would have been, this would have been the sort of depression years.
I did my midwifery, of course, in Lambeth. And we went into some pretty poor homes, I tell you. Yeah. And I remember a particular case, which was the first case that I made the diagnosis before anybody else. There I was, a medical student. And I happened to listen to this woman's. She had a fever of pyrexia of unknown origin, PUO. And I listened, and I thought I could hear a murmur. And it turned out she did have bacterial endocarditis, and that was fatal in those days. But she took a long time to die. And I remember going to her, I remember her husband was a French cook, either cook or pastry man, but anyhow, French. And I remember they lived in Lambeth. And I remember going to see her 2 or 3 times till she died. Yes. Oh, yes. Coronaries. Coronaries were dealt with by lying in bed, flat on your back, for 6 weeks. I can't imagine a worse thing to do. You'd lower them around. Make you dizzy when you stood up, so you thought your heart had had it for good. Oh, well, there you are. You do what you can.
Yes, it's interesting, you know, these how different these social conditions were. And that woman died, obviously.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, back then you got eyes, no joke. I mean,
yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I suppose, you know, perhaps later on we could get back, when we go right through your war experience, you would have been an NHS doctor.
Oh, yes. Well, I had another experience back there in the college when I had my myocardial infarct later on in life. And I was next to a patient with my bacterial endocarditis, and I saw what they did. It was amazing what they do now. This person came in a disgusting state, sanitarily. I mean, he was dirty, filthy, semi-conscious, had been found in his house in the state. And some clever bloke must have listened to his heart and found this murmur, and he was whisked into the heart hospital, Wimpole Street. And they discovered that he had this. He was in the theatre within about 4 hours. And they put a new valve in. And he had a hemiplegia too. I mean, he had a stroke and so on. And he recovered and walked out of hospital. Now, this was bacterial endocarditis, the terminal stages from which they recovered him. So there was that, my poor girl who took a long time to die. And here was this fellow in the last stages, being able to rescue, so that shows you the difference. And also, and how, I mean, I had a cardiac arrest and so on. I mean, all the different things that happened to one from the point of view of myocardial infarction, which didn't exist, and talk about you didn't. Now you can tell the lesion, but we don't want to talk about that. go back to Thomas's.
Yes. What were your aims, you know, once qualified? Did you want to become a GP?
Always wanted to do research. Always. It's a very strange thing. I always wanted to. I don't know where that came from. I think deep down, sounds a bit pompous possibly now, but in medicine, your whole, what you do is what other people have given you to be able to do. You don't do anything that somebody else hasn't thought of, which you are using. And I had a feeling that I'd like to contribute to this. Not just be a passive user of everybody, a sponge on the past. Be able to add a bit. I think that and curiosity, obviously, you're curious, you know. But I always want to do research, so there's no question about that. And, but what in? I wasn't terribly interested in what. That didn't bother me much. As long as it was looking into something, it didn't matter. But anyhow, my time at Thomas's was spent profitably, I think. My main thing was that I played ice hockey. We started as a team, ice hockey team, and then another one started at Guy's, then we had an inter-hospital team. We played Oxford and Cambridge and beat them. We beat them. Very pleased with ourselves. The best thing about that was that Doll was in our team. You know, the Doll, the cancer of the lung. You know. Well, then eventually I got qualified. I remember the year before 1938, when that appalling business of selling out Czechoslovakia. And I remember thinking that was a terrible disgrace. I was one of the few people. Everybody thought how wonderful it was that Chamberlain had come back and saved the day. And I remember being on top of a bus going to Thomas's and thinking how disgraceful and awful it was. Mind you, it was the best thing to do. We had a year to arm ourselves and build a few airplanes and get radar ready and so on. So in fact, I mean, had it been done with that in mind, all right. But it wasn't. It was put forward as if it was a wonderful thing to do. No, I remember that. But I do remember being so grateful that I had one more year to qualify, and the war hadn't started. The war didn't start until I qualified. Thank God for that, you know. When I qualified, I had £5 left. And I didn't want to take any more money from my mother. And I took the first job that I could find. I couldn't wait at Thomas's for a job. And so I went up to Scunthorpe. And I spent 6 months there, and that was an experience. There were three of us. There was a resident surgical officer, a house surgeon, and a house physician. The house surgeon, many years later, became professor of surgery at Sheffield, and I became professor of medicine in London, so I know we did quite well. The RSO was an Australian, and he was in charge of the whole works, really. I had a consultant physician in charge of me. There was no registrar. But after, I think, a week, I think I only saw him once, he crashed himself against a tree and was never seen again. And I was in charge of all the medicine as opposed to surgery, in that hospital, Scunthorpe Memorial Hospital. I was it. I was just qualified. I had no experience at all. Mind you, it's the most wonderful thing for doctors to be put in that position. You learn fast. You learn a lot very quickly, very responsibly. But I don't think it's terribly good for the patients. I was so worried by all this responsibility that I developed a peptic ulcer. I remember that. But the best thing that happened from the point of view of the war, which is what we were here for, was that the medical officer of health was, I can't remember names, it's terrible, but he was Hardston. He was a great friend of mine. I got to know him well. And he knew the BMA secretary.